dozen terrorists, they cannot get through to their three trapped comrades. In the attempt, a simple mistake will cost Sergeant LeDavid Johnson his life. He also becomes separated from the team. Sergeant Johnson and two Nigerian soldiers are quickly surrounded by the ISIS attackers. They are a half mile from the original ambush site. Before long, the three are shot to death. And it looks like there will be no escape for any of the Green Berets. They are surrounded, spread out over a square mile of desert and scrub. Puffs of red from smoke grenades waft through the air. The afternoon is hot and windy. On one part of the battlefield, Sergeants Wright, Johnson, and Black are finally overwhelmed and shot dead. They fight until the very end. ISIS fighters approach the bodies and mutilate them. The gruesome footage of the Americans' final moments will be placed on the internet as an Islamic State recruiting tool. The surviving seven Green Berets are now fighting desperately. With their trucks bogged down, they are now on foot. The Americans and 20 Nigerians form a defensive perimeter, tending to their wounded. A final radio call is made back to headquarters, stating that they are surrounded. Then the radios are destroyed so they will not fall into terrorist hands. The Nigerians get on their knees and pray. The Americans use their private phones to message loved ones back home, saying goodbye. But it is not all over. French Mirage fighter jets suddenly fly low over the battlefield. Within minutes, the terrorists flee. They leave behind 21 dead. French Puma helicopters soon land to rescue the remaining Americans and Nigerians and to evacuate the bodies of the dead. Sergeant LeDavid Johnson of Miami Gardens, Florida, who was once known as Wheelie because as a teenager he traveled around the city on a bike with no front wheel, is nowhere to be found. It will be a week before children will come upon his remains and notify the Americans. The fight makes Tongo Tongo the worst battlefield incident since the infamous Black Hawk Down tragedy in Somalia more than 20 years ago. Footnote: the bloody Tongo Tongo encounter lasted 3 hours and resulted in the loss of 4 American lives, 5 Nigerians, and 21 ISIS terrorists. End footnote. The slain Sergeant Jeremiah Johnson enjoyed being known as a man who did his job well and did not want glory. In fact, he left word with relatives that if tragedy should ever befall him on the battlefield, his name was not to be mentioned in the papers. After the ambush in Tongo Tongo, a reporter calls his mother asking for comment. But Debbie Gannon will not go on the record. "I'm going to honor his wishes," is all she will say. The date is June 28, 2021. The leader of the U.S. Africa Command, General Stephen Townsend, is talking to reporters almost 4 years after the Tongo Tongo ambush. The USAC no longer speaks of defeating terror, preferring to use the term containing. American troops are being pulled out of Africa, and U.S. airstrikes against terror groups have ceased altogether. Footnote: President Joe Biden ordered a cessation of airstrikes on African terror groups upon taking office in January 2021. No reason was given, nor was there any public announcement. End footnote. At the same time, ISIS and Al-Qaeda have recruited a new group of terrorists all across the African continent. Just 3 weeks ago, in the nation of Burkina Faso, which shares a border with the terror-troubled countries of Nigeria and Mali, 132 civilians were brutally murdered. Jihadists entered the village of Sohan late on a Friday night, burning homes and slaughtering innocent people. The level of atrocity has grown so high across Africa that citizens are becoming desensitized to the threat. It is now common for terrorists to intermarry into local tribes, insert themselves in local politics, and attempt to impose a caliphate. The terrorists seem to be unstoppable. Nowhere in Africa is this more apparent than in Mozambique. on March 24, 2021, in the resort town of Palma on the Indian Ocean, terrorists invade by land and sea. Many are teenagers. They number 200. The group is called Al-Sunnah wal-Jama'ah and has sworn loyalty to ISIS. The young terrorists rampage for days, killing indiscriminately until local beaches and city sidewalks are covered in headless bodies. The sophistication of the attack shows military precision. Banks, police stations, the local airfield, and an army barracks are destroyed. Palma is home to hundreds of foreigners working for a nearby French natural gas plant, many of whom barricade themselves in a hotel for almost 2 days waiting for rescue, only to have terrorists enter the building and behead those they capture. Thousands of locals flee into forests and coastal mangroves to hide. The Islamic State's news agency, Amaq, broadcasts the slaughter to the world. And though the terrorists leave Palma, their accomplishments are clear. The Mozambique government was unable to stop the raid. Just as in Syria and Iraq a decade ago, radical Muslim forces are now capable of terrorizing entire countries. As General Townsend bluntly states, ISIS and Al-Qaeda are on the march. If ISIS can carve out a new caliphate or Al-Qaeda can, they will do it. Footnote: there are few news bureaus staffed by American journalists in sub-Saharan Africa because it is simply too dangerous to live there. In the countries of Kenya and South Africa, there are freelance reporters. End footnote. Chapter 26. Western USA. The Beast of the East rides a Harley. Rory Larkin spent 10 years in the Middle East conducting hostage rescue missions. Every year on the 4th of July, he receives thank you texts from Americans he saved from beheading. Rory Larkin is not his real name. The ex-Navy SEAL prefers not to publicize his personal heroism, living by the code of Special Forces soldiers who defer always to brothers in the teams who have been killed in action. Rory is a stickler for keeping his word and living by the code of honor he learned in the military. He is single, no kids, his lone marriage to a former Playboy model a casualty to constant deployments. He has a dog named for a popular Irish whiskey. The graying warrior, now in his 50s, also has a titanium ankle, a compression fracture in his lower spine, and constant back pain, all caused by injuries suffered while stalking terrorists. Roy Larkin also has a rage problem. He refers to his occasional fury as an Irish wolfhound. He deals with the situation by contacting other military people who have shared experiences. It's kind of like Alcoholics Anonymous. When he feels his anger rising, he contacts someone to calm him down. Larkin attended the United States Naval Academy and went straight to the Navy's Basic Underwater Demolitions SEAL, BUDS, training in Coronado, California, the first step in earning his trident. After completing training, the newly minted operator attended Army Ranger School at Fort Benning, Georgia. He doesn't hesitate about his motivation at the time. When you make the choice to join Special Forces, you know you're going to war. That's why most of us join. We want to defend our country. We want to be warriors. We want to be downrange. But after 10 years in uniform, Larkin chose to leave the service for precisely the same reason he joined. America was not at war. No amount of training could substitute for actually going into combat. Then came 9/11. On September 12, 2001, Larkin phoned a Navy recruiter. Their initial conversation was brief. I served as a Navy SEAL officer but resigned my commission 4 years ago. Can I return to the Naval Service? How soon can you come to my office? The recruiter replied. I can be there today. 1 week later, Larkin formally returned to the military. Soon he was in Iraq, working hostage rescue missions, and not just for missing Americans. Larkin's first operation was to rescue two Bulgarian truck drivers kidnapped in Baghdad, Iraq. He failed. The men were eventually beheaded by Al-Qaeda and found floating in the Tigris River. The ransom demand for their return was not paid. Rory Larkin is openly critical of the U.S. State Department and, in particular, the FBI, which focused their efforts on Americans only. He claims he took calculated risks, but, just to be sure, carried three guns at all times, a rifle, a pistol, and a small 10-millimeter handgun hidden on his ankle. So I had a gun if I was thrown into the trunk of a car. Larkin constantly went outside the wire, secure U.S. bases within Iraq and Afghanistan, with special forces teams to gather intelligence. When SEALs or Green Berets go out at night, they are hunting, he says. They believe their skills are the best. Special forces go out because we want to be in the fight. We carried on our shoulders guilt and remorse when we couldn't be in the fight. Larkin well remembers the morning he awakened to reports that a CIA spy was in the hands of Al-Qaeda. The year was 2006. He opened a video link and saw an Iraqi local tied to a small chair. A sign with the handwritten letters CIA dangled from his neck by a string. The handheld footage was grainy and the images wobbly. One captor held up a small brown identity card for the camera. At the bottom was a yellow strip signifying that the man was allowed to enter the U.S. Green Zone in Baghdad. In essence, the Iraqi was being accused of being a spy because he cleaned toilets for the Americans. "This is for all of you," the terrorist captor said. A small group of jihadis stepped into the frame, gathering for a group photo around the terrified man tied to the chair. "Like it was a trophy hunt," Larkin remembers. The lead terrorist then lifted a 3-foot broadsword from a table behind him. Raising it high, he brought the sword down on the spy's neck. While telling the story, Larkin's voice becomes measured but enraged. The guy's head falls to the floor, and there's blood spraying everywhere, and these guys are dancing around in a frenzy, all of them chanting Allahu Akbar and God is great. Larkin, a Roman Catholic, finds these last moments of the 5-minute video the hardest to watch. "I just don't understand how a religion can glorify murder." In all, Rory Larkin worked 448 cases involving kidnapped hostages from all nations. No day was normal. They were all different, but they usually started with a beheading video. He spent 10 years in the Middle East before returning home, taking with him a case of post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, but leaving behind the Beast of the East nickname earned for his unstoppable work ethic. After all his years in the field, Rory Larkin is reflective on the battle against terrorism. "How we wage war and how the terrorists see it are completely different. It's about ideology and has everything to do with religion. These are hardcore fundamentalists. Their religion drives them to kill. They even murder people who share the same faith. Iraqi victims of this terror are in the tens of thousands since 2003. No one making U.S. and coalition strategy in the Middle East wants to say this, but religion is the difference. Let's put it this way. Those brothers of mine who carried out the bin Laden raid and got al-Baghdadi are the baddest MFers on the planet. No one badder. Every time they get on a bird to fly into a mission, they know there's a good chance they could die. But we were willing to die for our cause. The terrorists wanted to die for theirs." Larkin chooses his next words carefully. "The special forces fighting terror carry the burden of the greatest generation, which was our grandfathers in World War II. They fought with honor, and their victory was decisive. We strive to uphold the standards of our forefathers in Vietnam, and I have yet to meet a special forces operator from that war who was not successful on every mission. We always held ourselves to those high moral and ethical standards. No matter how bad a situation gets on a mission, my brothers would never dream of strapping on a suicide vest to kill." After 6 years, torment remains for Carl and Marsha Mueller, the parents of Kayla. They still live in the same house on the hill where she grew up. Both are retired. They make it a point to stay busy. Their son, 29-year-old Eric, lives nearby. Carl is still active in the Prescott, Arizona Kiwanis Club, but all his activities are shrouded by images of Kayla. Around here, there's not a day goes by when I don't think of her. I truly suffer because I couldn't get her home, Carl explains. He is gray-haired and lean, still uncomfortable talking about his daughter's death. I just feel like a failure. It's hard to lose her, and every day I think of that. It's not the retirement we expected. We're taking things one day at a time. We go on because Kayla would want us to go on. Time has not softened Carl and Marcia's anger over Kayla's murder. They believe her death was preventable and are now more openly critical of the U.S. government's handling of Kayla's disappearance than they were before. Both are patriotic, and before Kayla's abduction, not the sort of people to question the government. But that has changed. Kayla and the other hostages were the first Americans that illuminated the terrible nuisance of terrorism to the world, Carl Mueller told the authors of this book. The way the hostages suffered and the way the government handled it was all just a real debacle. America should have done what other countries do, get their people home. It is obvious that Kayla's father replays the horror constantly. He is haunted by what happened. I think we had 11 or 12 emails back and forth with ISIS. They wanted to get rid of Kayla. They wanted to send her home. But the Obama administration stopped us at every turn. They said they were doing everything they could to bring the American hostages home. We heard that from the FBI. We heard that from Lisa Monaco at Homeland Security. We heard that from President Obama. But they weren't. Marcia Mueller adds this. My faith in our government, my belief in everything they told us, changed. Because I realized Carl had been right all along. He would get mad at me because I had such belief in our government. He would tell me that politicians and bureaucrats weren't going to bring Kayla home. But I believed those people when they told me they would. It's heartbreaking when I go back to that. A parent should be there for their child. But the government was after al-Baghdadi, and Kayla was their ticket to him. They just wouldn't say so. Carl and Marcia Mueller did not see caution flags when Kayla first chose to work in the Middle East. It was their daughter's nature to help people in need, a pursuit that gave her life purpose and joy. Marcia remembers that her daughter's passion for helping others began in high school, where she received silver and gold presidential awards for volunteer service. After securing a $500 prize for being named Yavapai County Student of the Year, she immediately donated the money to the Home for Troubled Youth where she was working. While at Northern Arizona University, Kayla traveled to Guatemala with the Christian Youth Ministry and became so determined to help others that she returned to school and graduated in 2.5 years so that she might quickly go out into the world. Kayla Mueller endured typhoid in India, learned French because many aid agencies require the language, and wrote poems about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in a journal her parents would not discover until after her death. Our country gives so much to so many other countries because we have so much money, Kayla's mother says. These young American kids are encouraged, and they were especially encouraged by the Obama administration to go into the world and volunteer. But yet when they do, and something happens to them, there's no one there to help them. They're all alone. And there's no place for parents to go for help when this happens. That's wrong. There needs to be some way. We just can't leave them out there all alone. Marcia continues. I'd always say to her, Kayla, just remember, put the oxygen mask on yourself before you put it on others. But she always gave someone help before she did anything for herself. Marcia also remembers a conversation with Kayla the last time she came home for a visit, Christmas 2012. She had this mindset of, what are we doing? Why can't we get along? Why can't we agree to disagree and just figure out some way to make something for the good of everyone instead of just destruction, destruction? The Mueller's frustration with America's handling of the hostage situation began shortly after Kayla's kidnapping in August 2013. President Obama would not initially meet with the Muellers and the other parents of hostages. The administration had blinders on and did not believe that ISIS was a threat, says Kayla's father. They just thought they were powerless thugs, and they called them the JV team, and because of that, and because they didn't act, thousands and thousands of people were killed. Thousands of young Yazidi girls in Iraq were raped and sold from one soldier to the next. Marcia adds, President Obama wouldn't see us in the spring of 2014 when Kayla had already been held for 6 months. Even as we negotiated with ISIS through the FBI, the administration slammed the door on us at every turn. Footnote. In August 2014, President Obama stated that his administration was doing everything that we can to protect our people and the timeless values that we stand for, but avoided referring to Kayla by name. The Obama administration did not publicly confirm Kayla Mueller's kidnapping until February 2015, at which time the president reiterated that he was deploying all the assets that we can, working with all the coalition allies that we can to identify her location. And we are in very close contact with the family, trying to keep them updated. End footnote. Having no alternative, the Muellers continued working with government officials to secure their daughter's release. But increasingly, they became frustrated and bitter, especially with ISIS taunting them on social media. Then, a turning point in July 2014, the Special Forces raid on a suspected ISIS hideout in Syria came up empty. Footnote. That incident is portrayed earlier in this audiobook. End footnote. But the rescue attempt infuriated the ISIS captors, and they stepped up their threats against Kayla. Carl Mueller remembers, "When they did this raid on the 4th of July in real life, which we were not informed about, ISIS sent us an email on the 11th or 12th stating that, because of what your arrogant government has done, Kayla has just 30 days to live." The anger in Carl Mueller's voice rises. "I called the FBI negotiator and asked him about the raid. I don't believe he had any idea what I was talking about. But the administration continued to deny that the raid ever took place, even after Jim Foley was beheaded 1 month later. So, in order to save face, we finally got a call from the Obama administration saying the news of the raid had just leaked and they wanted us to know ahead of time. This is how we were treated." Footnote. It has been American policy since 9/11 to classify all covert anti-terror action. End footnote. Month after month, the Muellers continued to suffer, knowing their only daughter was in mortal danger. There was no relief, no rest. Carl Mueller defines the situation. "I think it was September 19th of 2014, we got an email from ISIS saying that Kayla's release was still obtainable. This would have probably been right before she was removed from the prison a day or two later and sent to the home where al-Baghdadi visited. The FBI saw that email, and I'm positive President Obama received a copy too. But right after that, he started bombing within Syria, and all communications stopped." Kayla's father then recalled the moment he heard on his car radio that the United States Senate had released a study about the torture of captured terrorist suspects. Immediately, Carl thought that put Kayla's life in danger. It was 2 years in the making. Senator Feinstein released it. I have since found out that President Obama had to sign off on it before it was released. I'll never forget that day. I was heading into town. Shocked me so much. I pulled off to the side of the road. I had Senator John McCain's cell number in my phone, and I called him. I said, "Senator, what's Feinstein doing? Doesn't she realize that my daughter is being held by the very comrades of the people she says we torture? Can you imagine what those hostages are enduring from those people now that this report has been released?" Footnote. John McCain said he would look into whether or not Kayla was being held by the same group being tortured at Guantanamo Bay Prison. Carl never got a response back, Marcia Mueller remembers. We didn't really expect to. Carl made his point. End footnote. Finally, staying in Arizona was too painful for the Mueller's. They spent the rest of 2014 traveling the world at their own expense in a desperate attempt to save their daughter. Washington, Turkey, and Qatar. The purpose of their journey was to arrange a ransom for Kayla. They traveled as private citizens, not involving the American government. Along the way, they heard that ISIS was anxious to get rid of Kayla. She represented a liability and put them at high risk. "We heard they just wanted to get rid of her," remembers Marcia, "and whether it's Mexico or the Middle East, they don't call it ransom, they call it barter. That's the way they do a deal. They barter. And we were being told the U.S. didn't pay ransom to terrorists, when in fact, it has been going on all along. The U.S. government doesn't want to admit it, but they always paid ransom or had somebody pay it for them. That's why we were in Qatar, to find someone to do it for us." "We traveled to Qatar to try and save our daughter," says Carl. "We did it without the government's consent. They told us they couldn't protect us and that we were on our own. We met with several officials in the Qatar government. The last important individual we met was their foreign minister. He came into the room and introduced himself, and he said that before the meeting, he wanted to let me know he'd just got off the phone with Secretary of State John Kerry. He informed me that Qatar would not help us pay ransom." That shocking statement almost caused Marcia Mueller to collapse. She couldn't speak. The Muellers both believed that somehow John Kerry had intruded on any deal. Marcia adds one final disturbing statement. "The government knew who it was that took Kayla out of the prison and was raping her. But they didn't tell us that. Instead, they led us to believe that they had a proof of life and that she was relatively okay. I remember asking the FBI agent who used those words, what exactly did he mean by relatively? And the person answered, poor choice of words." Footnote. President Obama called the Muellers soon after Kayla's death. A short time later, he issued a statement about his administration's dedication of enormous resources to freeing captives or hostages anywhere in the world. He also reiterated his determination not to pay ransom to terrorist kidnappers. "It's as tough as anything that I do. Having conversations with parents who understandably want, by any means necessary, for their children to be safe. We will do everything we can short of providing an incentive for future Americans to be caught." End footnote. Then came the dreaded outcome. Kayla Mueller was murdered in February 2015. Her parents changed their focus from rescuing Kayla to bringing her body home. There was little activity for the next 2 years. However, in January 2017, the Muellers gained access to the new Trump administration. They met with Vice President Mike Pence, CIA Director and later Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, Attorney General Jeff Sessions, National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien, and eventually President Trump himself. "I truly believe that if they would have been in power when Kayla was first taken, she would be here. I truly believe that," says Carl. The search for Kayla Mueller's body is ongoing. COVID-19 has hindered overseas travel, but the Muellers remain determined to find their daughter. They also continue to be mired in an unending tragedy, unable to close the terror-induced nightmare. To ease their pain, Carl and Marcia Mueller are now campaigning for new laws. They want the world to unite against terror. "There are no laws that pertain to what these terrorists are doing, and they know it. They use our legal system against us, they use our morals against us, and they reveled not only in holding our daughter and making her life miserable, but making us miserable as well. From those ISIS emails, I could tell they just enjoy having Americans in the palm of their hand and squeezing them." Interview complete, Carl adds one final word. "Most people go through life with blinders on. They care only about what color their next SUV is going to be, or their next house, or whatever else. They don't want to know about ISIS. Then Kayla Mueller's father shared with the authors a very personal piece of wisdom from his daughter. It came in a poem she wrote before going to the Middle East. If we can't handle learning about the darkest places in the world, they will turn into the darkest places in ourselves. Epilogue. August 26, 2021, Kabul, Afghanistan, 5:48 p.m. ISIS is about to murder Americans. United States Marines guard the Abbey Gate entrance to Hamid Karzai International Airport, 1 mile from the city center. Hundreds of frantic Afghan citizens crowd the entrance, desperate to flee the return of repressive Taliban rule in their homeland. The temperature is more than 90 degrees, and the air smells of human waste from a nearby sewage canal. Some of the desperate people even stand knee-deep in the fetid wastewater to cool themselves on this scorching summer evening. The evacuation process has gone on for days, and these Afghans have mostly waited with patience, knowing that 100,000 of their fellow citizens have already been flown out in the last 2 weeks. When their time comes to walk through the Abbey Gate, each man, woman, and child will be asked to show identification documents and be searched for weapons. The crowd is peaceful, full of hope that their lives will soon be changed forever. Which will happen, but not in the way these folks imagine. The coming disaster will be engineered by a man who does not want to leave Afghanistan. His name is Abdul Rahman Al-Logari, a young member of the radical group Islamic State Khorasan, ISIS-K, as they call themselves. Footnote: Khorasan is a region comprising parts of Iran, Afghanistan, and Turkmenistan that played a large role in the early history of Islam. The group chose this name because they deny that modern nations exist, preferring the symbolic power of invoking a time when the ancient Islamic caliphate was at the height of its power. End footnote. Al-Logari is a former engineering student who has been known to the Central Intelligence Agency to have had terrorist ties since at least 2017. At that time, he was plotting a suicide bombing in New Delhi, India. Tipped by the CIA, Indian officials arrested Al-Logari and turned him over to the United States. He remained in American custody until Kabul fell. Now the man stands just 15 feet from the nearest Marine. The terrorist wears a knee-length kurta tunic, lightweight pajama pants, and weathered leather shoes. Al-Logari hates the United States, having only recently escaped American custody at Bagram Air Base. ISIS-K is made up of Iraqis, Pakistanis, and Afghans. They consider themselves an elite unit, targeting foreigners, journalists, and high-profile targets like the Karzai Airport. Afghans who favor Western ways are considered collaborators by ISIS-K, and even the Taliban are suspect. Al-Logari waits in line like all the other would-be refugees, but concealed beneath his robe is one of the most lethal suicide vests imaginable. At 25 pounds, it is unusually large and bulky for an explosive device. Should he detonate the weapon perfectly, everyone within his line of sight, Americans and Afghans alike, will either be killed or horribly mutilated. The terrorist accepted his assignment yesterday from Shahab al-Muhajir, the leader of ISIS-K. The Marines know the terrorist is here, but they don't know what he looks like. They have been warned by the Taliban that there is a significant chance of a terror attack. Although there are two other entrance gates to Karzai International, the possibility of a bombing has closed them for today. Also, the United States, Great Britain, and Australia have all directed their citizens still remaining in Afghanistan to stay away from the airport. Instead, they are told to meet at a nearby hotel where they are flown in a military CH-47 helicopter to the runway. That order was given 4 days ago as thousands of ISIS prisoners were released from detention in nearby Bagram. The directive came from the U.S. State Department, which somehow did not calibrate the possibility that Abdul Rahman Al-Logari and others would immediately turn to mayhem. Some of the danger could have been avoided when President Joe Biden ordered the withdrawal of American forces from Afghanistan after 20 years of war. Bagram would have been a far more secure option for evacuations. The base, 45 miles north of Kabul, is ringed with anti-terror devices. It is much harder to penetrate than the Kabul airport. In just a few hours, President Biden will feel the repercussions of his decision to abandon Bagram in the middle of the night. Al-Lughari moves forward in line, unbothered. He can clearly see the faces of the young Marines near him. They are friendly, smiling, weary after a long day. Some are even women, a fact which offends Al-Lughari's religious beliefs because women should remain subservient to men. So to see them here, carrying a weapon and telling men what to do, is a violation of all that is sacred to the terrorist. The American military presence is everywhere, but it doesn't prevent Al-Lughari from easily assimilating into the crowd. There is no pre-security screening. And while the Taliban has stepped in from time to time to prevent refugees from behaving in an unruly manner, its focus is elsewhere, not on ISIS-K. The terrorist now steps close enough to smell the breath of the nearest Marine. It is not his turn to enter the gate, but he does not want to take a chance. He has made his decision. The suicide vest is made of thick plates of explosives, over which a fragmentation jacket filled with pieces of steel is fitted. In effect, Al-Lughari is a walking landmine. A simple detonator is attached, meaning all he has to do is push the button that will stimulate an electrical charge. The bomb will then detonate. Al-Lughari, age and origin unknown, well knows that his body will be instantly torn to pieces, even as his head is wrenched from its torso and flies away intact. No matter. He presses the button. Everyone within a 30-foot radius feels the ground give way as the massive explosion rocks the crowd. Arms and legs are torn from bodies and fly through the air. The percussion blast destroys the hearing of those who still live. Hundreds are dead or wounded, among them 11 United States Marines, one Army sergeant, and one Navy medic. 18 other Americans are wounded. From Washington, D.C., President Biden soon addresses the nation about the loss. "We will not forgive, we will not forget. We will hunt you down and make you pay. We will respond with force and precision at our time, at the place we choose and the moment of our choosing," says Biden. "Here's what you need to know. These ISIS terrorists will not win." The murders of the 13 U.S. service people and 169 others at the Kabul airport shocks the world. Immediately, anti-Biden brigades on social media blame the president himself. Those paid to defend him struggled to present a cogent argument. Bagram was secure, but it was abandoned. Why? There is no logical answer forthcoming. In the weeks to come, ISIS-K will quickly gather strength, coalescing in eastern Afghanistan. Yes, it is a sworn enemy of the Taliban, but the most desirable target for the new terror threat is the West, especially the United States of America. In Memoriam. Navy Corpsman Maxton Max W. Soviak, 22, of Berlin Heights, Ohio. Army Staff Sergeant Ryan C. Knaus, 23, of Corriton, Tennessee. Marine Corps Staff Sergeant Darren T. Hoover, Jr., 31, of Salt Lake City, Utah. Marine Corps Sergeant Johanny Rosario Pichardo, 25, of Lawrence, Massachusetts. Marine Corps Sergeant Nicole L. G., 23, of Sacramento, California. Marine Corps Lance Corporal Kareem M. Nakui, 20, of Norco, California. Marine Corps Lance Corporal Dylan R. Marola, 20, of Rancho Cucamonga, California. Marine Corps Lance Corporal Riley J. McCollum, 20, of Jackson, Wyoming. Marine Corps Lance Corporal Jared M. Schmitz, 20, of St. Charles, Missouri. Marine Corps Lance Corporal David L. Espinoza, 20, of Bravo, Texas. Marine Corps Corporal Umberto L. Sanchez, 22, of Logansport, Indiana. Marine Corps Corporal Dagan W. Page, 23, Omaha, Nebraska. Marine Corps Corporal Hunter Lopez, 22, of Indio, California. Killing the Killers, Terror Snapshot. Terrorism's global reach can best be understood by this overview of terror incidents during the two-year period of 2016 through 2017. This snapshot of terror details incidents not recorded in this audiobook, many of which did not attract major media attention. 2016. January 1st, 6 car bombs explode in Baghdad. August 7th, ISIS suicide bombers attack a U.S.-backed Syrian rebel base. Several people are killed. August 18th, ISIS suicide bombers kill at least 12 Syrian fighters. August 29th, ISIS kills 54 in a suicide attack on army recruits in Aden, Yemen. August 30th, ISIS spokesman Abu Muhammad al-Adnani is killed in a U.S. airstrike. September 9th, 3 French women connected with ISIS are arrested for planning to attack the Gare de Lyon train station in Paris. September 9th, suicide bombers attack the Al-Nakheel Mall in Baghdad, killing 12 people and injuring more than 40. September 11th, 3 women connected with ISIS attack a police station in Mombasa, Kenya. One officer is stabbed and the building is set on fire. September 17th through 18th, 9 people are stabbed by a lone man affiliated with ISIS at the Crossroads Center Mall in St. Cloud, Minnesota. September 26th, ISIS militants murder 5 individuals in Egypt for allegedly collaborating with the Egyptian army. October 14th, ISIS militants kill 12 Egyptian soldiers at a checkpoint in the Sinai Peninsula. October 24th, suicide bombers murder 61 sleeping police students at a training academy in Pakistan. October 27th through 29th, a Kenyan police officer is attacked by a lone man with a knife outside the U.S. Embassy in Nairobi. November 4th, ISIS kills 8 people with a car bomb in southern Turkey. November 12th, ISIS claims responsibility for a bomb blast at Shah Nurani Shrine in Baluchistan Province, Pakistan, that kills more than 50 people. November 19th, ISIS militia kills 5 police officers in an attack south of Mosul, Iraq. November 21st, ISIS claims responsibility for an attack on the Shia Bakir al-Ulum Mosque in Kabul. 30 people die. November 25th, ISIS claims responsibility for an attack on an Egyptian military checkpoint in the Sinai Peninsula. 12 soldiers die. November 27th, ISIS fires at Israeli troops patrolling the Golan Heights. 4 of the gunmen are then killed in an Israeli airstrike. December 11th through 13th, an ISIS suicide bomber attacks Cairo's largest Coptic cathedral, killing at least 25 people. December 18th, an ISIS suicide bomber kills at least 7 in an attack on Libyan forces in Benghazi. December 18th, ISIS suicide bombers kill 48 Yemeni security officials and wound dozens in the southern port of Aden. December 18th through 20th, gunmen lay siege to Karak Castle in southern Jordan, killing 9 and injuring 29 more in gunfire exchanges with security forces. Jordan declares an end to the siege after all 4 gunmen are eventually killed. The Islamic State claims responsibility for the attack. December 22nd, ISIS detonates 3 car bombs that kill at least 23, including 8 police officers, in Mosul. 2017. January 1st, ISIS kills 7 police officers at an Iraqi police checkpoint near Najaf. January 1st through 2nd, an ISIS gunman kills 39 people in a mass shooting at a nightclub in Istanbul. January 2nd, ISIS claims responsibility for a car bomb that kills 24 in Baghdad. ISIS militants also kill 7 police officers in a related attack. January 5th, ISIS kills 14 people in a Baghdad car bomb attack. January 6th, ISIS kills 4 Iraqi soldiers in Tikrit, Iraq. January 7th, a fuel truck detonates in a town in northern Syria, killing dozens. January 8th, ISIS detonates a car bomb at a vegetable market in Baghdad. 13 people are killed. January 9th through 10th, a suicide bomber attacks a security post in the city of El Arish, Egypt, killing 10 and wounding 22. January 19th, ISIS executes 12 people in Palmyra, Syria. January 20th, an ISIS car bomb kills 5 Turkish soldiers and injures 9 near the northern Syrian town of Al-Bab. February 7th through 8th, a suicide bomber attacks Afghanistan's Supreme Court in Kabul, killing 20 and injuring another 41. February 8th, ISIS gunmen attack the International Village Hotel in Somalia, killing 4 guards. February 10th, an ISIS suicide bomber attacks a restaurant in Mosul, killing 4. February 16th, an ISIS suicide bomber attacks a Sufi shrine in Pakistan. At least 72 people are killed, including 30 children. February 24th, an ISIS car bomb kills more than 50 people in the village of Susian, Syria. February 26th through 27th, an ISIS bomber attacking a police station in Algeria is shot and killed before he can enter the building. March 8th, ISIS gunmen dressed as medics attack a hospital in Kabul, killing more than 30. March 24th, an ISIS suicide bomber attacks security forces near an airport in Bangladesh. 2 police officers are injured. March 24th, ISIS militants attack a military base in Chechnya, killing 6 Russian soldiers. March 25th, ISIS bombings in Bangladesh result in 6 deaths and more than 40 wounded. March 29th, ISIS in Egypt beheads 2 men for practicing witchcraft and sorcery. April 7th, ISIS fighters killed dozens of civilians attempting to flee Mosul. April 9th, ISIS bombs 2 Catholic churches in Egypt on Palm Sunday. 65 worshippers are murdered. April 12th, an ISIS suicide bomber kills at least 5 people in an attack near the Afghan Defense Ministry in Kabul. April 18th, ISIS gunmen attack Egyptian security forces near St. Catherine's Monastery on the Sinai Peninsula. 1 police officer is killed and 4 more wounded. April 18th through 20th, an ISIS gunman kills a Paris police officer. April 21st, an ISIS gunman kills 2 in an attack on a regional Russian Federal Security Service office. April 28th, an ISIS car bomb kills 4 Iraqi traffic officers in Baghdad. April 29th, ISIS murders senior Afghan Taliban official Maulvi Daud in Peshawar, Pakistan. April 30th, ISIS fighters kill 3 Iraqi soldiers and wound 8 in an attack near the Syrian border. May 2nd, ISIS militants attack the Rajam al-Salibi refugee camp in Syria, killing 38 people. May 3rd, an ISIS suicide bomber kills 8 civilians after attacking a NATO convoy in Kabul. May 7th, ISIS suicide bombers kill 2 and injure 6 after attacking a military base home to U.S. military advisors in northern Iraq. May 12th, an ISIS bomb kills 25 and injures 35 more in Pakistan. May 15th, ISIS claims responsibility for 2 car bombs that kill at least 6 people near a refugee camp along the Syria-Jordan border. May 17th, Four ISIS gunmen and one suicide bomber kill six and injure at least 19 people in Afghanistan. May 18th, Islamic State militants kill 20 people near Aleppo, Syria. May 19th, an ISIS suicide car bomber murders several civilians near Basra. May 20th, ISIS fighters kill almost two dozen, including two children, in a village outside Deir ez-Zor. May 23rd, a car bomb kills four and injures 32 in Homs, Syria. May 24th through 25th, ISIS suicide bombers kill three Indonesian police officers in two blasts near a bus station in Jakarta. May 26th through 27th, ISIS gunmen attack a bus carrying Coptic Christians in Egypt, killing at least 28 people. May 30th, an ISIS car bomb kills 13 people and injures 30 in Baghdad. May 31st through June 1st, ISIS gunmen attack an Algerian military patrol unit south of Algiers. Four soldiers are wounded. June 5th, an ISIS gunman holds a woman hostage in Melbourne. Three officers are injured in the resulting standoff before Australian authorities shoot the terrorist dead. June 8th, ISIS admits to murdering two Chinese teachers kidnapped in Pakistan. June 9th, an ISIS female suicide bomber kills at least 31 people and injures 35 at an Iraqi market in Al-Musayyab. July 7th, ISIS suicide car bombs kill at least 23 Egyptian soldiers and injure another 26 at two military checkpoints in the Sinai Peninsula. July 10th, a U.S. Army sergeant stationed in Hawaii is arrested for attempting to provide drone aircraft and combat training instructions to the Islamic State. July 17th, an ISIS car bomb kills four people at a security checkpoint in northeast Syria. August 9th, ISIS kills four Egyptian police officers in an attack on a patrol car in the Sinai Peninsula. August 14th, a suspected ISIS militant stabs and kills a Turkish police officer while being taken into custody. August 17th through 22nd, ISIS claims responsibility for an attack by a man driving a van through a crowded pedestrian area in Barcelona. At least 13 people are dead and more than 80 injured. August 19th, a man inspired by ISIS attacks several people with a knife in the Siberian city of Surgut, Russia. There are no fatalities. August 25th, ISIS fighters attack the Shia Imam Zamin Mosque in Kabul during Friday prayers. 30 worshippers are killed. August 25th through 26th, an ISIS-inspired man carrying a knife attacks two soldiers in Brussels. The attacker is shot dead. August 28th, an ISIS car bomb kills at least 8 people and injures 25 in an attack at a vegetable market in a Shia district of Baghdad. August 30th, ISIS claims responsibility for a suicide attack in Jalalabad on the home of the Deputy Speaker of the Afghan Parliament. August 31st, ISIS murders two police officers in a suicide attack on a police station in western Algeria. September 2nd, ISIS suicide bombers attack a power station north of Baghdad, killing 7 people. September 14th, ISIS militants attack a police checkpoint and two other targets in southern Iraq. At least 60 people are killed. September 29th, ISIS kills one and injures 5 in a suicide attack near the Shia Husseinia Mosque in Kabul, Afghanistan. October 1st, an ISIS fighter shouting Allahu Akbar stabs two women to death in a knife attack in the southern French port city of Marseille. October 1st through 2nd, ISIS murders more than 60 civilians in central Syria. October 2nd through 3rd, two ISIS suicide bombers attack a police station in Damascus, killing at least 10. October 3rd, ISIS releases a video showing two captured Russian soldiers in Deir ez-Zor, Syria. Russia denies that any troops have been taken prisoner. October 4th, ISIS gunmen kill at least 4 and injure another 40 in a suicide attack in Libya. October 5th, an ISIS suicide bomber kills 18 people in southwest Pakistan. October 11th, ISIS suicide bombers attack police in Damascus, killing 2 and injuring 6. October 12th, ISIS kills at least 50 people in 3 car bomb attacks in northeast Syria. October 13th, ISIS murders 6 Egyptian soldiers in an attack on a military post in the Sinai Peninsula. October 15th, ISIS militants attack security outposts in the Sinai Peninsula, killing 6 soldiers and injuring more than 20. October 20th, ISIS suicide bombers kill 72 people in attacks on 2 mosques in Afghanistan. October 24th through 26th, ISIS murders 8 soldiers and 1 civilian in northeast Nigeria. November 5th, an ISIS suicide car bomber kills 15 and injures 20 in South Yemen. November 7th, ISIS gunmen disguised as police kill 2 at a television station in Kabul. November 14th, an ISIS car bomb kills at least 6 people in Aden. November 16th, an ISIS suicide bomber kills 9 in Kabul, Afghanistan. November 17th, an ISIS-planted car bomb kills 20 people and injures another 30 in Syria. November 24th, ISIS militants attack a Sufi mosque on the Sinai Peninsula, killing 305 people and injuring at least 128 others. Note on sources. Writing a book on terrorism is a unique research challenge. The key players live in a clandestine world, whether it be the terrorists themselves, the intelligence agencies who shadow them, or the special forces operators who do the hunting. In a world of TikTok and YouTube where it seems like everyone is trying to be famous, these men and women do their best to remain almost completely out of the limelight. But the information is out there. Not all of it. There are some events in this book that will not be fully revealed to the public for years. In those instances, we opted for as much detail as the research allowed, only writing in specifics when facts could be verified. The rest, all the stuff that's still top secret, we did not even try to guess about and chose to let those details remain vague. We were helped to an extreme amount by 5 wise men whose names shall remain off the record. They spoke on background under the condition of anonymity. Very often the interviews veered into a level of confidentiality whereupon the authors were politely told, "I can't answer that question." But for the data that could be discussed, these gentlemen provided opinions and details. Their wealth of experience and in-depth knowledge of the subject matter is formidable, and all thanks go to them for being patient and kind in answering what must to them have felt like very basic questions. In addition to the hurdle of writing about a topic that is still highly classified, there was the issue of travel. A normal part of writing a killing book is going to the locations being described, whether that be walking one of Crazy Horse's battlefields or visiting the site of a gangland slaying. Nothing beats studying the land to provide context while trying to set a scene. But COVID and terrorism made travel a no-go for this book. Other than a long layover in Istanbul, there were no visits to the Middle East during the writing process. Most locations are off-limits or war zones. Instead, we made great use of satellite imagery to see the color of soil, the density of a forest, the width of roads, and 1,000 other details that seem minor until you start trying to describe something. The same should also be said about the plethora of video footage now available online, allowing the same view of a location or event as if we had been there ourselves. Not surprisingly, online newspaper databases are an enormous help in researching terror. Google an event, and the same day in history will be described in dozens of different newspapers. We leaned on papers from New York, Tehran, Paris, London, and cities across Asia and Africa. Some depend upon the wire services, which is obvious when the exact same article is run in big city newspapers around the world. The trick is finding the newspapers that do their own reporting, digging deep into a happening to provide specifics other writers don't put in their stories. The caliber of a weapon, temperature, local color, and many other tiny details for which researchers like us are truly thankful. It is a common practice to mine the bibliographies of well-researched books on a topic. This is a roadmap into the data hunt. But while those books on terror are definitely out there, we didn't lean on them. Most events we describe are too recent for books to offer the sort of perspective that can be found by looking back on an event 30 or 50 years later. But there were a few we consulted, mostly about the Bin Laden raid or General Soleimani. A great thanks to those authors for their expertise and attention to detail. And finally, an enormous thanks to the family of Kayla Mueller. This is Robert Petkoff. We hope you've enjoyed this production of Killing the Killers, a Macmillan audio production for SMP Audio. This title was produced by Guy Oldfield. Text, copyright 2022 by Bill O'Reilly and Martin Dugard. Production copyright 2022 by Macmillan Audio. All rights reserved. Please keep listening to hear an excerpt from Killing the Killers, The Secret War Against Terrorists by Bill O'Reilly and Martin Dugard. Thanks for listening. You can buy this audiobook from wherever audiobooks are sold.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.